Hello and welcome to the Underwater Sunshine podcast. Welcome back to podcast number two of the Purple Rain of Prince in the 80s. And we're on right now. It's 1981. And so we're into Controversy. This is the first album that I really loved by Prince. The first that I remember knowing, because Dirty Mind, like I said in the last podcast, I remember reading about it. I remember the review in Rolling Stone, but I don't remember really getting into the record. I remember hearing about him opening for the Stones, but what I remember when I came back from boarding school, I think, going to a house party in Oakland at a friend of mine's house and hearing this record playing, and I was just fucking hooked for life with Prince. It knocked me out. And after that, I went back to Dirty Mind. 1981's a really weird year, too, though, because, like,
it's a great year for music, though.
It is, but it's a weird year for all of our lives. President Reagan has become president. We've just skipped the Moscow Olympics.
Yeah.
Because of the thing going on in Afghanistan before that.
For me, it was a big transitional year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was coming to the end of high school for me. It was my senior year in high school just starting. The mental illness problem had just started to kick in the year before when I was away at boarding school for a year. And I didn't have much of a vision of a future for myself, but also the world was starting to get into this real feeling of apocalypse. That was a very present theme in, like, it just was a weird time where we were all really worried about what was going on, and it felt tense in a way that I hadn't felt in my life really before that. A sense of just general fear and discomfort in the world. You know, the first recorded AIDS cases came around then, although I don't think most of us knew that yet.
Yeah, there's something about a transition, getting back to Prince too, and he's speaking of this because the very cover of this record with all the headlines and the ripped pages and him again with the Rude Boy and looking very, very bisexual. And he talks about it in his very first, and it's named Controversy. Here's a guy who took a lot of shit when he opened up for the Stones, took a lot of shit from a lot of people for wearing the panties and the high heels and everything. His band confronting sexuality. He was starting to get some blowback from what will be now an interesting buttress of what Prince is doing on the progressive side and what's happening during a much more conservative time in America. Well, you'll see, you know, Ed Meese and the Department of Justice go after pornography, rock music, the PMRC, this idea that we have to stop that whole craziness of the 70s, the drugs, the sexuality, all this stuff. Yeah. That's what's happening in the zeitgeist. But here's Prince buttressing up against that. And Controversy speaks directly to that. He's actually responding to all the critics that didn't get into the Uptown theory, the philosophy we were talking about, Uptown, the people on the outside. And he sings about himself in Controversy. Am I straight? Am I gay? Am I black? Am I white? You know, and then in the middle of it, he says the Lord's Prayer. And it's his first foray into Christianity. Here's where he will do something even more controversial than Head or Sister. He will conflate religious transmogrification with sexual release. Sex through seeing God, being closer to God. It's a very, very weird thing, and he starts to get into it on this record, especially the first side where he goes from Controversy into sexuality into what he says was the most important song of the first half of his career, Do Me Baby, which is his first real sexual long-form ballad that's a funky soul ballad that really ends up this side. It's a brilliant side of music, and it comes at a time, as you said, that was really kind of a transition time for America.
Well, it's a bleak time in the world, and Prince comes along to talk about, like, sex, politics, fun, hypocrisy, and anger all at once.
Yes.
And he really does do this. And you have to remember that, like, there's this backlash against disco, which everyone's saying disco sucks.
Right.
And they're against black music. And then Prince kind of comes back to sort of take some of that back to say, like, and he's an outsider. He's like indie cool when he does Dirty Mind. And when he comes out to say this, and everyone who sees it, because not very many people know about him yet, he's not dealing with mass culture yet. He's dealing with a few music critics who really are the only people listening when he's doing Dirty Mind.
And he's trying to break through in a very white area in Minneapolis.
But he's also he's not being heard by those white people because Dirty Mind doesn't break through. So when he first comes out doing all that stuff, he's to a certain extent preaching to the converted because he's only being heard by a bunch of rock critics probably who are sort of saying he's the second coming, he's the greatest thing. But when he does get out into the mainstream with it, when the Stones, he's appreciated by rock critics, he's appreciated by Mick Jagger, who's miles ahead of everybody else musically. And they, but when they bring him out into the center of popular culture, when he goes to actually open for the Stones in front of everyone, they throw things at him.
Yes.
And that's his first experience with, like, because he's been really cool up till that point. He's been everybody's wunderkind. He's the young kid who can play all the instruments. People have done nothing but praise him. He's had all the potential in the world to be big. No one's ever said, you fucking suck to him.
Right, right.
And what happens when he gets out in the mainstream is everyone says, a bunch of people say, no, no, you fucking suck. When he faces those forces that he's been sort of batting back against, you know, from the late 70s, when he, the first time he actually gets out into facing them, he gets hit pretty hard.
Right. And here's a man who never did talk to anybody. He didn't do any interviews, very, very shy, painfully shy, and he was still creating this character. He was insulated in this world. He's working with The Time. He's working with Vanity 6. He's got all these outfits. He's got all these songs. But when he pulls it, when he puts himself out there, the controversy of it, the controversy, the very title of this record and the title track, which again, like Dirty Mind, opens up the record, is a grand statement. He creates this controversy, and he gets the shitstorm back. And he realizes, okay, okay, like Lenny Bruce, this is what you get? Like Sinead O'Connor ripping up a picture of the Pope, this is what you get? You're going to make a big stand like this? There's a lot of people out there like, hey, you know what? Keep your mouth shut, put on some fucking clothes, stop talking about straight and gay and having these philosophies. And he feels this because he's such a sensitive kid.
But as he does with everything throughout his career, he doesn't react to it, to getting thrown stuff on stuff at him on stage. He doesn't react to it by retreating or going insular. He embraces the controversy and makes the album Controversy.
Turns it into like art.
He always dives into it more. He wants to fully explain, expand, and expound upon what he's talking about. It's also a record me and all my friends could dig. Like, I remember when we were starting out, it's like the late 70s, we're in 7th grade, and we're all listening to Earth, Wind & Fire's The Commodores, Elvis Costello, and Joe Jackson. It feels like everyone I know, black and white, likes all this music. Maybe that's just my crowd right then.
No, you're right.
But we're still listening to music together, different kinds of music. And that sort of splinters a bit in the latter, over the next 6 or 7 years. But now it's my senior year in high school, not my first year in junior high. And Prince comes along, and what I find is that we're all there listening to it together again. We're all, I really remember that sense of, oh no, we're all back listening to music again. And maybe everybody all over Oakland is. I don't know. I definitely wasn't listening to the hip hop yet. But I don't know if my other friends, you know, my black friends who were more from Oakland were or not, but I wasn't yet. But in 1981, when Controversy comes out, we're all listening to Prince. You know, and I don't remember whether that's all over town or not. Other things to talk about is, like, one of the things people forget, because we all talk about how he can play so many instruments, and it's easy to forget, you know. Even with the many instruments, they get overshadowed by his guitar playing.
But also expertly, by the way. He's not just playing these instruments. He's the plays best them better bass player than anybody we've seen. He's the best piano player, the best guitar
drummer.
Player.
He's better at everything than everybody else. But the one even among those, he tends to get overshadowed by his guitar playing, because that's the thing you see him doing on the front of the stage.
Right.
So it's easy to forget, you know, that everything on 1999 is actually keyboards. It's easy to forget that he's playing the drums and the bass on all this shit. All the funkiest shit anyone's doing right then is him.
Yep.
And he's playing the drums and the bass on that stuff too. But it's possible with all that to overshadow the vocal stuff. Not just his lead singing, but his arrangement of vocal melodies, his arrangement of harmonies and chords. He writes the best melodies, but he actually has this melodic, this quality of the organization of the layered vocals, and he's doing it over much so on For You. It's one of the things that costs so much money is laying down 12 vocal parts at a time.
Right.
He pulls it back for the next couple records, but here on Controversy and on 1999, he starts to really expand the vocals back out again. And doing, because he can do more, he can sing so many different ways that he's able to do things with harmonies and with layers. He builds dynamics, not out of necessarily just building drums and guitars to be louder, although he does that too, but he'll build them just with vocal stuff. And it's incredible because he can do so many different things with his voice.
And you hear his actual voice on this record more than the first three. He's not falsettoing all over the joint in this. He does, of course, but you're starting to hear the voice that he will bring to some of 1999 and especially to Purple Rain.
Yeah. And these melodies that he writes are what make the difference. That's the through line, because if you can write a melody like When You Were Mine or Sexuality or the change from the verse to the B section in Controversy, then it doesn't matter if it's a funk song or a pop song or an R&B song. And you'll hear this with Do Me Baby, which is 7 or 8 minutes long, but is so incredibly melodic that it doesn't matter that it's a slow jam. It works for everybody, because if you're going to write melodies like Paul McCartney's Beatles songs, then you can put them in any kind of song
right.
you
they
want.
They got great bones. That's what I always say about songs. You can do them in any way you want.
That level of melodic composition makes everything he does pop music.
Yeah, it's true.
Because it's all good enough that you can't get it out of your head. And that's one of the simpler reasons why all kinds of people, races, sexes, sexualities, are all drawn to Prince, because you just can't get the shit out of your head.
Yeah, and even the people from the 60s, that's why he got all the rock critics. The people from the 60s that were pooing a lot of stuff in the early 70s and then embraced punk really dug Prince, because he's taking them back. He's still edgy. He's a pop star. He's a rock star. He's a funk and soul master. But he could write a ballad like nobody's business, but he's still edgy. There's an edge to this record, just like in Dirty Mind. He has not lost that kind of street cred.
Well, he very purposely also seems to want to speak to everyone living on the fringes, whether that means being straight or gay or black or white. You know, Prince seems to be saying, you're okay. In fact, you're actually wonderful for being so funky and brave and different from everybody else. And it's not only saying it's all right to be you to everyone, but he's saying the people that don't think you're okay and don't think you're all right, that part of society is fucking whack.
Right.
And not to just like say to them, you're fucked. It's you're missing out.
Yes. Because like we said about with the Uptown.
Yeah.
You're the ones that are, you know, if you're going to be a bigot, then you're not going to open up your eyes. Look, it's like the old saying about the Negro Leagues and Major League Baseball. You know, no black people, no Hispanic people could play baseball for the first half of the 20th century. And there were so amazing players, Cool Papa Bell, Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson.
Josh Gibson.
Some of the greatest players that people didn't get to see because of some stupid color line.
Yeah.
So that's what he's saying in these songs. And he's saying it in 1981, not 1881.
So let's get to the... Because it, strangely enough, once again needs to be said in 1981.
No kidding.
It shouldn't, but it does
but
need
it does.
To be said again,
and
just like it does
in
now.
In 2020.
Yeah, I mean, let's get to the first song, because it's the title song of the record. It opens it up. Like Dirty Mind, it starts the album up on a stomping bass kick drum. It's a protest marching beat under a bass synth melody line and some insanely funky Prince chicken scratch guitar.
Yes.
It is a call to revolt. And a call to question everything that begins with the lyrics. Am I black or white? Am I straight or gay? The first chorus asks, do I believe in God? Do I believe in me? And continues on with, we're all just the same, before eventually flirting with what a lot of people, as you mentioned before, consider total blasphemy by reciting the Lord's Prayer in the bridge to the song.
Yes.
In one of his patented chants, at the end of the song, Prince manages to combine his feelings about being misunderstood, his challenge to open sexuality, and his vision of a utopian world that ignores racial and sexual differences, all in this one chant. He loves to use these chants on these records. Like showed, it's at the end of Cool, at the end of the last one. It's at the end. We sang the one that's at the end of Party Up, although we didn't play Party Up. And in this one, people call me rude. I wish we all were nude. I wish there was no black or white. I wish there were no rules. A childlike chant, the kind that kids do in the schoolyard to tease each other with. But what he's saying is, people call me rude. I wish we all were nude. I wish there was no black or white. I wish there were no rules.
And listen to the way the music plays under that. There's something very, very visceral and extremely evocative when he plays the music under that. And he comes in with this great harmony at one point. So he's building it up like, okay, it's a singular voice that believes this. Now here comes another voice, and it gets to build up into this point. Like you said, it's a movement. It goes from a singular voice, and by evoking God and saying the Lord's Prayer, in essence, he's talking about maybe the Jesus movement or the early movements and messianic movements. He's becoming his own messiah. He's creating his own myth.
And this is not Dirty Mind. He's back. It's not a 30-minute record. He's back to wanting to stretch things out. Not every song, but on some of these songs, he's willing to let it go. It's so funky, he's like, I'm not cutting this song off at 4 minutes. It's too funky, and especially right on the first song, Controversy, he lets it go for 7.
He starts now, and you'll see it in the next record, 1999, he starts making like full tracks that are like half the record side, and you know, 8-9 minute tracks, because he can do it. He's up till 3 a.m. building these tracks out. You can picture him building it out.
He does some of this at Uptown in Minneapolis, and some of this at Sunset Sound.
I know he recorded quite a bit at Sunset Sound, for sure.
Yeah, so this is, let's start it right
in
off.
LA,
this is the opening track of Controversy.
Controversy.
Thank you.
see. Do I believe God? Do I believe me?
There was no black and white. I wish there were no rules. People call me rude.
This is also the first time.
Oof. Yeah. It's so cool that he throws those in. Yeah. Just like he's willing to use his like voice as a bass drum or, a, I mean, as a kick drum or a bass line. He keeps, and it's not regular. As you pointed out,
yeah,
while we're listening,
it's
not regular.
The, oof. Oof. Reminds me so much as the bomb goes boom from 1999. I was about to say, this is the first in a series of what I call funk fugues that Prince did, in which he builds upon a singular groove. He does it in Erotic City, is his masterpiece at that, but he does it in, like, Let's Pretend We're Married, where he starts off with just a, and then it, then it builds up, and he adds another part, and then he does it on the guitar, and then it's, then he breaks it all down again, and comes with another part, and then like that, I forgot that he did like that off-kilter, row, row, row your boat kind of thing, where, as I said earlier, he's a singular voice saying, I wish there were no rules. But now other people join him. Obviously,
yeah, off the beat,
him,
saying
right.
it on the half, like it's around. Right. He does a lot of stuff with staggered vocals throughout his records. Left and right ears are having hymns. It's still him on both, but he's a little bit behind sometimes, and he'll bring it back together
yes.
for the effect of bringing
it's
it back together.
It's a headphone symphony is what it is.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, he plays a lot with the mistimed vocals that are... It's a magnificent song.
And it really is. And he's using some of it. You know, for the first time, too, you see some of the later influences of P-Funk in here. George Clinton, who he'll work with in the late, in the early 90s, I think. Late 80s, early 90s. He will work with George Clinton, who you met, was the first person to ever ask you for an autograph,
yeah,
I think,
yeah.
the story you told me. It's not as much in the earlier stuff. He was much more in the Earth, Wind, and Fire, as I said earlier, Commodore's vein. But here you're getting down and dirty funk here. And definitely some rock and roll sentiment. But again, an amazing way to open up this record, which he's talking about the shitstorm that came after him. And also, I got to tell you, there's a poster. I have it. That came with this record of Prince in the shower with his bikini bottoms, and hanging on the wall of the shower is a crucifix. I mean, that alone.
Well, you got to remember that Prince, as a guy calling into question ideas of sexuality, of sex, of race, of gender, and then
religion.
Also religion, is not just throwing the religion in there to poke people. The fact is that Prince is an incredibly religious man.
Yes, he was.
He's
his
a
father
very
was.
Deeply religious Christian.
Yes.
And... when he brings those questions in, it's not just because he wants to poke you and say Christianity is sexuality. It's all like I feel like more of like when Madonna doing it in Like a Prayer is more that. But he's also he wants you to think about the fact that I'm a deeply religious man, but sex is a part of my life and love is a part of my life, and you have to bring all these things together when you make your decisions. And those of you out there who are conservative Christians who are out there telling everybody what they should and shouldn't be,
right.
you have to question all these things.
Right. His whole thing is that the basis of life, of human life, which God puts into you, or a supreme being, or whatever the center of the universe is, he's saying is not separate from all the other things. It's a natural affinity towards, and it's love. It's like I evoked Lenny Bruce's name earlier, but Lenny used to have this bit where he's like, "How come you could watch somebody get mutilated on TV and you allow your kids to see it, but God forbid they see like a tit on television? Like when you know." Janet Jackson's breast came out for 2 seconds during the Super Bowl. It was like the humanity fell apart. Whereas. You know, there's violence is part of the culture, and he plays with a lot of that. At one point in this song, I think he sings, "Murder, baby." He just sticks it in there. Like, all this, all the imagery is coming at you, and there is a conflation of sexuality and religion, and he does it, and you're right, it's coming from a genuine place. What he's saying is, it's not like Madonna, who was a Christian, named Madonna, by the way, Italian, raised in an Italian family. And she's pushing it back because she's got that fight with Catholicism, like Sinead O'Connor. Prince is like, I'm not interested in your Catholicism or your Protestantism. This is how I see God, and I'm expressing it in my art. But, of course, 1981 especially, very controversial.
Well, he's making a point, too, that if God created us with the ability to love each other and to love him, and if that's an important part of it, he also created us with the ability, the desire, and the need to fuck. In fact, as part of his creation, the only way the species continues...
Right.
is if we fuck.
This desire.
And he built the desire to fuck into us, and as a part of the need to, the only way to propagate and continue the species is to do it.
Right.
And these are all part of who we are, you know,
And there's a freedom, and like I said, these songs are liberating. He's liberating the sexual concept from this idea. And of course, there was already a sexual revolution in the 60s and 70s. So he is part of a lineage. He's got, that's why a lot of, like, again, a lot of the 60s and 70s critics really, really went nuts for Prince, because he's bringing a lot of that stuff back that was kind of lost, I think.
Well, and it this plays right into the second song of the album, which is Sexuality, which is an incredibly funky song. This bass keyboard groove pulsing under the funk scratch guitar. And throughout these records, it is an under... He is playing this chicken scratch guitar on songs all over these records, and he is so fucking good as a rhythm guitar player.
Yes.
Not just his leads, his rhythm parts are purposeful and specific. And funk, people can think, is just about playing along but with a groove, but it actually... You need the holes in funk to make it work, and the only way the holes are there is if you are very specific about the kinds of things you play. And he plays these rhythm guitar parts over his entire career, and they'll come up over and over again. Some songs, they're more clearly audible than others, that are a masterclass in how to fuck to do
right,
it.
Right, and there are signatures. So he'll do it at the end of 1999, which is a real big keyboard song on a very big keyboard album. Yes, and this is a double time of the first one. The first one is sort of fat back, as you said, four on the floor, real funk song. This one's a little quicker. This one's got a little bit more step to it. It's got a little bit more rock and roll to it, but it's very, very funky. And it's, again, a very political song. It's conflating sexuality with spirituality and with freedom. For gender and for race and all those things. Again, his philosophy's in there.
It's a protest song. It begins with the cry, stand up, everybody. This is your life. That's what he says right at the beginning of the song, which is the kind of thing that isn't said in protest songs anymore at that point. People weren't writing any, but he wants you to be clear at the very beginning of the song. This is a protest song like all those protest songs you all lined up behind,
yes,
you know, 15 years ago. Stand up, everybody. This is your life. You know, let me take you to another world. Let me take you tonight. You don't need no money. You don't need no clothes. The second coming, anything goes. Sexuality is all you'll ever need. Sexuality, let your body be free. He's got this chant thing going on later in the song, which is we saw him introduce it in Party Up. It came up again in Cool. We saw it in the last song. In this one is the reproduction of a new breed. Leaders, stand up. Organize. Over and over again. Reproduction of a new breed. Leaders, stand up. Organize. Everybody.
Once again, the second coming, another reference to Christ.
And it's not just a song about sex like Dirty Mind, but it's a song about what sex leads to, because he's very carefully... The thing sex leads to is children, who are either the beginning of something good, a future, or dumbass airheads who are going nowhere right. in life. And he makes that point that you have responsibility to fuck, but you have responsibility to fuck with thought and purpose. He says later on there's a whole...
About television, and if you teach your children, you don't teach your children
to
read.
Well, yes, he says, there's a whole spoken interlude at the end of the song. We live in a world overrun by tourists. Tourists, 89 flowers on their back, inventors of the Accu-Jack. They look at life through a pocket camera. What, no flash again? They're all a bunch of double drags who teach their kids that love is bad. Half of the staff of their brain is on vacation. That's a great line. Mama, are you listening?
Half of the staff of the brain is on vacation.
And then he brings the chant back. Mama, are you listening? We need a new breed. Leaders, stand up. Organize. Don't let your children watch television until they know how to read, or else all they'll know how to do is cuss, fight, and breed. No child is bad from the beginning. They only imitate their atmosphere. If they're in a company of tourists, alcohol, and U.S. history, what's to be expected is 3 minus 3. Absolutely nothing. Stand up. Organize.
You know,
reproduction of a new breed. Leaders, stand up. Organize. I want to be in the new breed. Stand up. Organize. He's making a point about this that is, it is about sex. It is about love. But it's also about, like, as I've pointed out in other songs, it's about so much more than that. Because he wants you to think about what, not just fucking either. What does the fucking do? It creates these children. And if you as parents who are fucking creating children don't teach them to be better, then they'll be shit.
Right. Well, they can only evolve. And I've always talked about that. Evolution is the way of salvation, whether it's evolution in thought for peace, evolution in thought for anti-bigotry, evolution in thought for gender issues, evolution in thought for political issues. Everything is about an evolution. And Prince was constantly talking about, in all of his records, he always put, may you live to see the dawn. It was somewhat spiritual, but really it was about dawning. I wrote that eulogy for him for the cover of the Aquarian. Thank you for your kind words about it. And when he died, and I said that statement, that he never even sang, but it was on all of his records, may you live to see the dawn, I believed was the enlightenment. He's talking about enlightenment and seeing things past gender, past race. And he lived it and wrote about it, and he showed it. His band was intergender, interracial. It's how he expressed it. And this song is very much as political a song as Uptown. And he even uses the same stuff. He uses the word tourists, for a negative thing. He uses the double drag again, which he uses in another song. So there's certain touchstones, there's certain words that he will use going forward that are new ways, like the way he uses the number two instead of T-O-O or T-W-O.
He's not doing yet.
He's really creating a new language.
Yeah. And I mean, he also realizes something sobering that is important to realize because of his age. One of the most significant parts of every person's life is when we first rebel, when we become part of a rebellion, our youth against our parents. But then there's usually in every kid's life a societal part of rebellion where we begin to say, like, no, the world's not that way, and we're against that.
Right.
And a bit of a minor revolution, and we get involved with it politically, socially, whatever it is, and we feel the world change in some way. Well, Prince was born in 1954, so he's 58. So he's, you know,
he's part of our generation. That's not quite boomer, but not quite X.
He's 23 now, 24,
right?
And he's been through the revolution. He was there. He grew up in the 60s. He watched us all revolt. He watched society gather behind a movement. He watched us all believe, you know, in unison, listen to music about believing in something, in change,
right,
about making it. He watched us all get together and make something change. He watched Vietnam happen and stop because we all believed in change or whatever.
Why'd you watch the president quit?
And then he watched it,
like we did,
all come back around again. And here he finds himself in 1981.
Right. And Shining City on a Hill.
Draft registration has been reinstated.
Yes.
We're back with the conservative president again.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the sobering lessons that you learn as an adult, is that the world does rebel, that we all do gather together to make revolutions. And then after a few years of buying the products of the revolution on TV and in the mall,
it's cyclical.
I wouldn't say nothing, but they don't go all the way like we thought they were going to, and they come back around again to a newly conservative country, and we're finding ourselves in it again, yet again now. And one of the things that you learn as an adult that kind of sucks is that the world doesn't all get together and change. It changes a little bit sometimes, and then it goes back around again, that it is cyclical, like you said. And at this point where he's living, for whatever reason, he finds that people need to be reminded yet again. We had the whole civil rights movement in the 60s, you know, integration of a lot of things, and then somehow here we are again in 1981, and he's got to remind you again that it's okay to be black, people are treating us like it's not
right,
and that in fact there's this new thing about being gay that you're ready to, you know, that we haven't learned from the thing before it.
Yeah, but even now with LGBT rights and everything like that, there is movements out there. There is marriage equality now. 1981, that seemed like a billion miles away. People were still, and then just like you said, the advent of AIDS. I will say this really quick.
No, but what we're talking about right now, and what a lot of people in our society are finding out, is that they don't have marriage equality like they wanted to. That we think of it as a given, and guess what? We have it in New York, but it doesn't go on everywhere. And that the rights of gay people are not the same everywhere. And that, like, we need to talk about it again now.
Right, but at least you have some law that you can go to back then.
Well, there's always there were civil rights laws, but then again in 1980 you find that people are being discriminated against again.
Right.
You know, my point is that one of the things you realize throughout your life as you get older is that it is important to keep believing and keep saying what's true.
Right, because, and evolve.
Because it comes around. Because the rest of society is not coming along with you all the way the first time.
Right, especially when you're young. Yeah. Like you said, you become very myopic. You see things a certain way. I will say this. I read, like I said, I'll reference this occasionally throughout these podcasts. I had to review Prince's autobiography, which was something he was working on when he died. And the gentleman that worked on him with the book was able to cobble together pages. And one of the things he said was the awakening for him was he convinced his father, who was a very religious man, to take him to see the Woodstock movie. He really wanted to see the Woodstock movie because he wanted to see Sly, he went to see Santana, and he went to see Hendrix specifically. But he said he was moved that day because his father was a great jazz musician. He was named Prince. My mother asked me about this recently. Is that his real name? I'm like, yes, he was named after his father's band and his father, John L. Nelson. And his father went with him to see Woodstock, and his father had no respect at all for the rock and roll movement. But he said the two of them almost were in tears watching it. They were just so moved by the whole idea of everyone getting together. Black, white, older, younger, long hair, hippie, cops help. We talked about it on our Woodstock series. A lot of people helped out there. The National Guard working with Abbie Hoffman and the people being fed, and then the music, the rock music of the Who and the jam music and the Hispanic flavors and Hendrix. He said he knew right then what he wanted to do with his life. And the fact that his father was right there with him, a guy who he revered as a musician and as a religious man, it's a big deal. And that's all I hear when I hear controversy and I hear sexuality. I hear that kid being awakened and then sharing that.
Well, at the end of the song, when you're listening to it, I talked about his rhythm guitar, his chicken scratch rhythm guitar playing. There's a part near the end of the song where it breaks down to him singing the chorus, "Sexuality is all I ever need," just over his guitar. And it really, it's very audible right there, the details of what he's playing and how funky it is and how clear. It's not just a strumming part. It is spectacular funk rhythm guitar playing.
It really is.
And when you should listen to it when it gets to that point. But let's play the song. Reproduction of a New Breed. Leaders Stand Up.
Organize.
This is Sexuality.
Again. They're all a bunch of double drags to teach the kids that love is bad. Half of the staff of their brain is on vacation.
Mama, are you listening?
We need a new breed. Leaders, stand up, organize.
Yeah. Don't let your children watch television until they know how to read. Or else all they'll know how to do is cuss, fight, and bleed. No child is bad from the beginning.
They only imitate their atmosphere.
Sexuality, I'm gonna let my body be free.
He's using a little bit of electronic drums there. He's not quite in the drum machine realm yet, but he's using a little electronic drums to go with the other one and just like that stuff to give it that extra. And I love how he just comes in with that crazy Hendrix style, you know, guitar out of nowhere. It's the only really touch of rock music in there, but just a wonderful song.
Yeah. Well, I love the way, even in the spoken word section, he's using the vocal arrangement to build up and exaggerate the moments, to punch up certain moments dynamically, you know, like
cuss, fight, and bleed.
Yeah, that one. Or suddenly bringing the chant back in for "we need a new breed of a breed."
Yeah.
Stand up. Just for that one line, he brings the chant back underneath him so he can say it, you know.
Everybody.
They only imitate their atmosphere. He uses, like, the vocals to take all these moments and like, pick them up to, like, accentuate. It's the word I was looking for. God, did I ever search for the word there? Fuck, accentuate is the word I was looking for.
Yeah, and this only works, I think, in the construct of the singular man building it up. I called it the funk fugue. This one is a little bit like that too, although this is a steady groove all the way through. There are moments in there you could almost hear him with the playback. Okay, I got another idea. I'm going to add this. And then when I hear this idea, I'm going to add this. It's like he's just cobbling it together, but he's doing it in such an organic way. It doesn't seem like one guy in there just building tracks. It's very one thing inspires another thing, which inspires yet another thing. And it's just wonderful. He's able to do that the way Counting Crows would do that. Like, you know, one guy would play one thing and then another guy would play the other thing because that guy's playing that thing. You've told me many times it's about hearing and having space to create. He's doing that all by himself, building. He's like, oh, I played that part. When I come back around, I'm going to play this part on keyboard and accentuate that.
Well, it's one of the reasons I think it probably makes it easier for him to do it alone, because he doesn't have to explain it to other people.
Correct.
He can just create, arrange, and play it. He hears it in his head. He just plays it.
Sure.
He doesn't have to tell it to someone else to play it. That's why some of the few times he uses other people are, like, for instance, when Matt Fink comes up with the keyboard part for Dirty Mind.
Right, and then he lets him alone, and he builds a whole song around it, and then comes back and has him play on it.
Yeah. So the long, slow jam is a classic part of R&B, going back to a million reasons by Earth, Wind, and Fire at 8 minutes, or God, what's that? What's the Commodores one on?
Not Easy.
Easy by the Commodores. Yeah. And Prince, as much as any artist, both excelled at and paid a regular kind of tribute to the concept, because he's such a strong melodicist and singer and player that these things don't end up ever being genre tropes. They end up being just really strong songs.
And this is the first of those.
Yeah. I mean, the hook, he does a shorter version of it on Dirty Mind with what's the song we left off? We didn't play it.
Broken Heart Again.
Got a Broken Heart Again, sort of. But that's not really a slow jam in the way that Do Me Baby is, or International Lover on 1999.
Right. Condition of the Heart later on Around the World in a Day, or Beautiful Ones on Purple Rain. There are Adore is his masterpiece, which is the last song on his finest record, I think, Sign of the Times. There, he had mastered that. I've often joked
Purple Rain, too. It's
Purple Rain, too.
It's a little more of a classic rock thing, but it's also in the slow jam territory. It's not that different from Do Me Baby in its own way, too.
And he believed that Do Me Baby was the beginning of that for him. And I've often joked that this is the kind of song that Prince can write at 2 in the morning, falling out of bed. You know, it's his thing. It's all over that triple album, Emancipation years later. He really starts playing with that. He loved the stylistics. He loved that kind of – he loved the Temptations. Like you said, there's a lot of Smokey Robinson in that. But this is a combination of his down and dirty sexual – I mean, this song is – really blush-inducing. There's no doubt about it. If you're listening to this song and you're not with a girl, or you're not listening to it on a dance floor or something, if you're listening to it by yourself, you're like, wow, this is this is close to the bone, almost pornography on record. Not unlike Love to Love You Baby by Donna Summer, which I think is a masterpiece, really. It's basically called groaning over like a backbeat, but it's something very visceral about it. But he also gains what you were talking about before, that great balance of a great soul ballad. You know, have you ever loved a woman? Things like that, you know.
Well, the strength of the melodies and his strength as a player are what allow these things to also go 6, 7, 8 minutes long at times, as some of them do. He makes this a very sexual experience, this song, full of, like, carnal hunger.
Yes.
You feel the hunger in it. But in typical, atypical Prince fashion, he's going to twist it around on you. It's about them sitting in the room thinking about making love, talking about making love, not necessarily making love. Right. They're getting ready to. And finally, he says, instead of ending his seduction by having sex with his partner, he sings, "You're leaving me no choice. Okay, what are you going to do? You're going to just sit there and watch?" All
right. Right.
And then he takes care of himself while she watches. Yeah, he jerks exactly. himself off. Are you sure you don't want to close your eyes? Well, isn't it supposed to take a long time? I'm not going to stop until the war is over. And then he says, "Help me there. Okay, okay." And then at the very end of the song, "I'm so cold, just hold me."
Yeah, you know, and, like, but the way he says it too, yeah. "I'm so cold." I mean, it's very Isaac Hayes. It's very Barry White.
Right, but none of them would end it by jerking themselves off.
Yeah.
But his point is, like, this is real. It's sexuality. People do this too. And in fact, it's really hot and kinky for me to just do it in front of you.
Right.
If that's what you want.
Right.
Because he's been seducing her the whole time and she's still sitting there. So he finally says, "Okay, what, you want to just watch me do it?" Because he's not going to let you... He's
Stop
not going to let you relax
getting.
And lay down into what you're comfortable with, your way of having his sexuality. He's going to say, you know what? Even if you've gone through this whole song, which is so carnal, and there's so much aching and moaning right. and shit going on, I'm not going to let you get used to that. At the end, I'm just going to jerk off.
Right. Well, it's an individual song, much like this record, in sexuality and even controversy. He's emancipating himself as well. If you remember in Uptown, he's emancipating the girl, and then eventually they make love. In this song, he's like, "I'm going to get off. And I don't care. I don't care if you're involved in that. This is an individual thing I'm doing. My sexuality is going to trump even your reticence to get nasty with me." And in essence, he's like, it's a great seduction song, and you're right. It's got an undercurrent that only Prince can pull off. I mean, Barry White wouldn't have done this. Isaac Hayes wouldn't have done this. Otis Redding wouldn't have done this. None of these guys who had this real male kind of... They would have done these songs.
Openly sexual, but they wouldn't have done this at the end.
No,
because it's not cool to
admit... It's no conquest.
To masturbation, it's all conquest. It's not cool to admit to masturbation
right.
or to maybe doing it to show off for someone else, for
right.
their kink. And Prince is like, I'll do that.
Right, right. And then,
care.
Of course, he ends the first side with "Do Me Baby," and he ends the record with a song called "Jack You Off."
I'll jack you off. You know,
So I'll do it for you if you'd like. Oh man,
he wants to explore amazing. All the parts of sexuality, not just men loving men, women loving women, but also men jacking themselves off. In my case, me jacking. It's not lame or the way you would use the word gay, not
or
you.
Or
the way people use the word gay to be, the way people use gay as a negative. It's not any of those things
right.
to masturbate. It's just another part of sexuality.
Right.
And I'm going to use it right here.
That's true. And we should mention that it's his first foray into masturbation on a record, but it would be masturbation in Darling Nikki that would get Tipper Gore all aggravated and start the PMRC. That was that song
yeah.
about the girl masturbating with a magazine. But these are the kind of things that he was bringing up at the time. But beyond all that, musically, this thing is the template. It's the foundation for everything that Prince would do in the love song, in the seduction song, in the cool funk slow soul jam that he would make really his own, I believe, in which separate him really from almost all the artists of this period like this.
Very few people can pull off a 7-minute and 44-second song of this type without it being, after
boring.
A while, boring. Like, there's very few I can think of. I will say that Reasons, that Earth, Wind & Fire song, is one of the few that can go that kind of length, especially the live version of it, where they because they built it all the way through. They were great composers and arrangers themselves. And here, Prince pulls it off as well.
I think this is a masterpiece. Yeah. I really do. It's provocative. It's got some good, again, he's just doing that. But, I mean, at a musical level and a singing level... Oh, my goodness. And I will say, this always got the biggest cheers and hoots and hollers whenever I saw him play live. When he would do this, even if he only did one verse of it, he used to do this piano bit where he'd bring the grand piano and just for like 15, 20 minutes, he'd be on there and he'd just do a few bars of "Do Me Baby." Place went nuts. It's like one of those songs that are very, very connected to his fans. They all, especially the female fans, but really it's one of those songs that like, yeah, "Do Me Baby, that's cool."
Well, it could be a throwaway song on another record, and it's not because it's him. Not at all. It's a great song. When we were talking about what songs to play here and there, both of us were like, we got to play Doobie Baby. There was never a question of leaving it off.
Yeah.
And here it is.
It's a groundbreaker.
Prince.
Staring each other down. to lay me down. For a love like ours is never out of season. So baby, please stop teasing me. What you do?
we always sit and listen to the songs, obviously. I made the joke to Adam, maybe we could skip this because we both know this like the back of our hand. But then you hear it in here, and again, we were just marveling at the piano playing, the cool slapping of the bass. And he does one thing where he actually bends the bass notes, woo, 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 and those great keyboards that come in and out. And obviously, the vocal performance is tremendous. You know, they often said about singers like Judy Garland or Diana Ross or Barbara Streisand that they're acting while they're singing. There's acting going on. They're playing a part. And in there, he does a fantastic job. Just a fantastic job of just playing that part. And he would always kick everyone out of the room when he did vocals, all the time, from the age of 20 all the way up till his 50s. He would never want anybody in the room, so he could really get into the moment and really place it. And then, as you said earlier, compound it, put more vocals on top of it to give it, you know, those screams in there are just visceral. They're like right from the gut, you know?
Well, Peggy McCreary, who was the engineer for... I think something happened. He was working at a studio in L.A., not Sunset Sound, and the board went down, and they were going to move to Sunset Sound. They called up this woman, Peggy McCreary, and said, are you free? Can you just work with this guy? He's really talented, but, you know, he's just needs someone, an engineer in there with him. And so, you know, he did a lot of the records with just him and her for a while there, for this, for... the stuff that was done at Sunset Sound, this 1999, I think a lot of
Purple
Rain. Well,
that's when
Rain.
Susan Rogers comes in, and she worked with him all the way through. She was the one that was on call that he would call her
well, I
up.
Think
and
after she's later when he goes back to Minneapolis, but at Sunset Sound, it's Peggy McCreary. I think,
okay.
Who does all the stuff with him, and he when he finally relocates to Kiowa and he's going to just stay in Paisley Park and record. He asks Peggy McCreary to relocate, to move from L.A. to Minneapolis, and she's like, I can't. And that's when she stopped working. And that's, when I think, when Susan Rogers comes on.
Okay.
But for a lot of these records now, it's Peggy McCreary in there. And she said she finally got around to just – because he liked to sit at the board and do stuff, and because he was so creative with the vocals, she just got into building basically a mic stand that would come right off the front of the board. So he could sit at the board and sing and work the board. So he could just record endless vocal takes himself, and she could leave at times. But
and produce and engineer himself. Sure.
Yeah.
It's an aria. It's a masterpiece. It's a wonderful soul ballad, and it's got the edge to it. He never loses, and it's one of the great first sides of, you know, popular music history, for as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it ends right there. The second side is yet another Prince sort of like. The second side of Controversy, like the second side of Dirty Mind, is one of these musical pinball machines he does where he shoots it from one song to the other like Whiplash. You bounce off like bumpers of endings into beginnings of songs. He's not trying to make them flow into each other comfortably. He's like trying to snap you around. And this one starts with a very fun kind of rave up Private Joy. And then it pinballs into this like very 50s-ish Ronnie Talk to Russia before it's too late. And then, which is a, you know, we're going to blow up the world is a lyric in there. And then it snaps into the funk of Let's Work and then into Annie Christian, which is this really eerie song. And I want to talk about a few of these songs, but we want to play you like the end of Ronnie Talk to Russia and then run through Let's Work and Annie Christian so you could hear kind of where he's going. And Annie Christian to me has always been one of the most interesting songs. It's a very eerie and sort of disturbing song about the world going to hell in the 1980s.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know...
And once again, the last name Christian is important because we've already established that with a couple of songs, references to Christ and the and religion we talked about before, and the Lord's Prayer in Controversy. But here it's interesting because Annie Christian, the song title is actually the headline of one of the newspaper articles that are on the front cover or the
Annie,
back.
Annie Christian sentenced to die, on the front cover,
right? Yeah, and I think Annie Christian also was another non de plume of his.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I believe. I could be wrong, but I think there's quite a few of them. Jamie Starr, you mentioned, Alexander, Nevermind.
Yeah.
But anyway,
you got to remember what's going on in the world right now. Russia has invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. boycotted the Moscow Olympics. The embassy in Tehran a few years ago was occupied.
Right.
John Hinckley murdered John Lennon, and Squeaky Fromm shot President Reagan.
Oh, you're thinking of Chapman. Chapman killed
I mean,
Lennon,
Chapman killed...
And Hinckley shot Reagan.
Oh, Squeaky Fromm tried to shoot Gerald Ford. Yeah.
I'm up on my assassinations and my attempted assassination.
Also, at the same time, and this is, I think, a part of this song, in the years right previous to this, in fact, in 1981, I believe it's still going on, 28 black children disappeared and then were murdered in Atlanta.
Yes.
And they, right around the same time, they found Wayne Williams and was convicted of it, a lot of people thought he didn't necessarily do it. He was found driving around in his blue station wagon, which is what it comes up in here. He says Annie Christian wanted to be a big star, so she moved to Atlanta and she bought a blue car. She killed black children, and what's fair is fair. If you try and say you're crazy, everybody say electric chair. And then there's like a call and response cheer. Electric chair! Which is a weird fucking thing to be cheering.
It's a weird musical. It's the music in this is very unsettling.
And the chorus is Annie Christian. And it's not anti. It's the word. It's the name Annie.
Right.
Annie Christian, Annie Christ. Until you're crucified, I'll live my life in taxicabs. Annie Christian, Annie Christ. Until you're crucified, I'll live my life in taxicabs. You know, and he has this theme of the taxicabs, which
yes,
he returns
does.
To in Lady Cab Driver.
Like tourist,
as
like
if
the other ones.
They're this metaphor for, maybe because they're always in motion, they're this metaphor for a place of safety somewhat mm-hmm. that you flee to.
Also impermanence, also finding new places but never really getting there. There's a lot of that stuff. Listen, there's no way, it's just like 89 flowers on your back. I mean, what does that really mean? Does
it's
it even
a Hawaiian
matter
shirt.
What it means?
It's a Hawaiian shirt.
It's a what?
It's a Hawaiian shirt.
Oh, that's
tourists,
what that is?
You know, tourists running around in Hawaiian
oh,
shirts.
Oh, I never knew that.
Oh, yeah. I'm assuming that's what it is.
89 flowers. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's got to be those ugly little, like, Hawaiian
never
tourist
knew
shirts.
That.
Yeah.
Nice work.
You know, it's a... Because he talks in some of these... Not on this record. It's more on later, but people going to... No, it is on this record. Going to Disneyland. Yeah, the tourists are in Disneyland.
Yeah, with the phone.
On,
no flash again.
On sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's a really incredibly... This is the song where, like on 1999 in There's Something in the Water Does Not Compute, where he does, all through this, he plays against the sort of stereotype of how synths are used in popular music, which has been a lot more like distancing, like we talked about New Order or Depeche Mode,
right.
Cold and distancing. He's playing them very warm and creatively, but on this song, he uses dissonance, just like he does on Something in the Water Does Not Compute on 1999. He uses dissonance and colder tones and pitchy things that are out of the key that to make you uncomfortable.
It's it's a disturbing theme and a disturbing sound. You know, and I often credit Gary Numan's Cars, which I think is one of the more influential songs of the 1980s. Because he's got those minor key sounds going over like this driving thing. And Prince does that beautifully in 1999. And a lot of the songs, all of a sudden, they start going really dark on you. I mentioned that in the last podcast. And this song really is his first, I believe, kind of a, like I said, a very, he's trying to create this dystopian atmosphere with the music.
So I want you to hear this, because I want you to hear the musical... The breadth of the second. We're going to play you a little bit of Ronnie Talk to Russia, into Let's Work, into Annie Christian. This is the second side, a lot of the second side of Controversy.
I didn't want you.
such a weird song. I always forget that he's not singing on it. He's just like different, like 10 different vocals layered of him talking, yelling.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of singing.
There's like, this really cool kind of like, sounds like a soundtrack to like a suspense movie towards the end.
Yeah.
Like Hitchcockian. Yeah, it's great. That's a mood setter. So that's the rest of the last 30 seconds or so of Ronnie Talk to Russia, as we said, this song in which he's pleading to Reagan not to blow the world up. And then Let's Work, which is a classic Prince funk layout. Really good, smack in the middle of this album with all different kind of musical styles. And then that, which is, again, extremely experimental. It's different. I like the rain falling keyboard, you know, throughout the whole thing that kind of works against the vocals, which are very stark. And again, they're spoken. And just these concepts about gun control, electric chair, the murder of John Lennon, the attempted assassination of Ronald
Reagan. Uses this character and gives her the blame for all these things that were going on around the world at the time.
And like you said, there's some conflation there of anti-Christian, anti-Christ, but it's Annie. Nice play on words. It's the kind of thing that he was always working with, which is why, whether he was working with musical styles or producing or playing the instruments or writing his lyrics, there were a lot of thought put into that.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't just crank these out. And he's building these myths. He's building these characters, like I'll Spend My Life in Taxicabs, as just a negative feeling. These tourists, this negative concept. And then these positive things, like Uptown and trying to get there, or, you know, May You Live to See the Dawn. All these different ways that he bowed. You know, a couple of podcasts ago, we were talking about Daniel Johnston in a different way, also a person at a very young age, was filled with this creativity of creating all these different characters, good against evil, constantly. And Prince works in that milieu quite a bit.
Yeah, it's the sort of mythos he's created, like of Uptown as this utopian place on Dirty Mind, and at the same time he's creating this sort of like dystopian America. I don't know if he's creating or he's just writing songs about it, because it's actually there.
Yeah,
on controversy and talking about all the things that are going wrong in the world, just a lot of very famous mainstream terror, murder, assassination. There's a lot of things going on that are very, very scary. And he's, you know, talking about that throughout this album. While he also talks about sex and freedom, he's talking about, like, we're all a little nervous right now about the world. You know, we are. And that's going to come into full bloom on 1999. But it's here already now. And he begins it with Party Up a little bit also.
Yes.
But, you know...
But it's also in the great lineage. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Phil.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say it's in the great lineage of Sam Cooke, you know, or Marvin Gaye's. You know, What's Going On? I mean, there's social commentary there that for a while had been lost. Like I said, during the disco era of in dance music or in black acts or something like that. So he's reaching back to that folk tradition of common. You know, having, you know, like what's the song? The Stephen Stills song, Buffalo Springfield song. You know what I'm talking about? About the cops and shooting in the streets. This idea of, you know, I'm an artist, I should kind of figure out what's going on with all of this. It's not a call to revolution, say, like Street Fighting Man or anything like that, or Eve of Destruction, but it's this comment of like, hey, I'm creating these songs, but it's not completely in a vacuum. I do live in this world. Yeah, he does a great job of infusing all of these things onto this record, which does break out from Dirty Mind and is a wonderful bridge to one of his great masterpieces.
To where he's going, you know.
1999.
Yeah. He's willing to, even though it isn't really much of a band, he makes it sound more like a band on this record because he's got this vision in his head of this idea of the revolution that he wants to do. And he almost calls 1999 a record made by Prince and the Revolution. In the end, he writes the revolution on the back of the record
in backwards
lettering or something.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he's got this idea in his head, and he starts to bring it into the fore a little bit at the end of the record. At the end of the record, having been very serious about a number of things, he decides to kind of have a little bit of a laugh at himself, too. But he also, some of the people come in, Dr. Fink and Lisa Coleman both play keyboards on this last song. Lisa Coleman sings on it. Bobby Z actually comes in and plays drums on it. It's the first anyone's played drums other than Prince on one of these records.
Right. Bobby Z, who will be in the Revolution, and is in the film.
And he writes a song, very serious about the end of Do Me Baby, about let's have sex. Okay, well, how about if I just masturbate for you? He's all very serious about it there. But at the end of the record, he kind of has a little bit of a laugh at himself with a song called Jack You Off, which actually is the first place I was wrong about this. This is where the alternate spellings first appear, is the U and Jack You Off.
Yes.
This album is the first appearance of the purple theme and the first appearance of the alternate spellings.
Right.
The lyrics of the song, if you're looking for somewhere to go, thought I'd take you to a movie show, sitting in the back, and I'll jack you off.
Yes.
I can't give you everything. Oh, sorry.
No, go.
I can't give you everything you want, but I can take you to the restaurant. If you're not hungry, I'll jack you off. If your man ain't no good, come over to my neighborhood. We can jump in the sack, and I'll jack you off.
Right, right.
If you're tired of the masturbator, little girl, we can go on a date, and if you like, I'll jack you off. And then he sings, I'll jack you off over and over again.
Jack you off. Yeah, it's very, very much like
an I want to finish this off because these are great.
Yeah.
The second verse, I only do it for a worthy cause, virginity or menopause. You'll have an instant heart attack if I jack you off. If you really, really want to be a star, which is what Andy Christian wanted, by the way,
right.
We got to do it in your mama's car. Mm-hmm. Naked in a Cadillac, I'll jack you off. If we can't find no place to go, girl, I'll take you to a movie show. We can sit in the back and I'll jack you off. And then the chorus again, all right, the bridge says, say we put some funk on here, I'll jack you off. If you ain't a chicken, baby, come here. If you're good, I'll even let you steer. As a matter of fact, you can jack me off. Yeah, that's right. And then it goes into the outro choruses. I mean, he's having a little bit of fun with this one.
Yeah, and then he talks about his mama's car. It's, I'm going to lay you down in daddy's car on Dirty Mind. So he's playing with his lyrics that he had on the last record. And I love that you could jack me off. Bump, 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 bump. It's yeah. Got a little bit of, Take the A-Train. It's got a little bit of the old big band style. And I said to Adam, we were debating about, he and I would play every song, but we can't, you know. And actually, we dedicated, now that I think about it, an entire podcast to controversy, and for a reason. And, it's got what a lot of people compared him to Hendrix because of the guitar thing and the black and white players in the band. But I think, and even Little Richard at the time was like, my God, this guy's totally stole my whole hairdo, my screaming, my overt sexuality. I mean, you know, Tutti Frutti, the original lyrics of Tutti Frutti would make, Prince blush probably. So, and that was way earlier than 1981. But yes, this is where he just gets his inner Little Richard out here a little bit. And he's very playful about it because it has been an album of darker themes. It's an album of a little bit of vengeance on his part with controversy, like, hey, stop pointing your finger at me and start looking at yourself. It's got some overtones and undertones of religion. God is mentioned for the first time, which will appear in every one of his records from now on, even that, as the voice of God that opens up the next record in a way. And it's got the purple theme in it, and it's got his use of the different letters. So as you see here, just like we said, like the Beatles, he's giving you something different every record. He's building these myths, and you can't wait to find out what he's going to say next or what he's going to do next. But he ends, as you said, on a very high and fun note.
Yeah, and he leaves you with that. And we're going to leave you out. We're going to play the song, and then we're going to leave you. And we'll be back in another week to start really looking at 1999 and the rest of Prince's work after that. And if you can't find anything to do over the next few days, Prince has a suggestion for you, how to spend your time. All right. This has been the Underwater Sunshine Podcast.
I'm James.
I'm Adam.
Peace.
Late. Jack you off.
Show, sit in the back, and I'll jack you off. I can't give you everything you want. jack me off.